Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you joining us on this day as we talk about luscious landscapes. What do you think about that? The Green Bay Botanical Garden Spring Thaw Symposium is coming up. It's April 9th. Yeah, April 9th from 9 to 3. And I kind of love the location because they're meeting at the Tundra Lodge Resort on Lombardi Avenue in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And we have a couple of the featured speakers at that symposium with us today to talk about how we can make our design our landscape and make our landscape not only beautiful, but provide some great edibles as well. And I'm glad to that I have with me in the studio Stephen Ziegler. He is an award-winning landscape architect who's worked in all aspects of the field: hands-on landscape construction, regional planning, environmental research, landscape design and construction. He owns Ziegler Design Associates in Middleton. It's a professional landscape architecture, land planning, and garden design firm. Stephen, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Larry.
I really appreciate you stopping by today. With us by phone is Lee Reich. Lee is the author. He's an author and an avid farm dinner. And, you know, that's a combination of the words farm and garden, gardener. So he's a combination of the two. He did a lot of plant and soil research with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also, he was at Cornell University. Finally turned his attention to writing and consulting. He has a website, leereich.com, and has authored a number of books. The Pruning Book, Weedless Gardening, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, Landscaping and Fruits. He's done a lot, and it's great to have him with us as well. Lee Reich, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us. Well, you are both speaking at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens Spring Thaw Symposium. And I wonder, why are events like this important to both home gardeners and perhaps professionals like you? And let me start with Lee. Lee Reich, you want to comment on that?
Well, one thing is, I've always found that people are really enthusiastic, especially this time of year, and it's nice to get around other people that have similar enthusiasm, and then you get to learn a lot too. Hopefully, the speakers are good.
Well,
see other and talk to other people that have similar interests.
And Stephen, what about you?
Yeah. Well, it's very important to communicate across the board with different professionals and to get the garden clubs and the gardeners in particularly excited about the upcoming spring, the spring thaw up there. I still hear they have over a foot of snow on the ground. So,
Well, we get a little snowing in southern Wisconsin as we speak as well. And Lee, you do describe yourself as a farm dinner. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's how I say it. It's a word I'm trying to put into the language.
And how'd you come up with it? And did I describe it accurately? What is it? What it means?
Yeah. Well, it started out. I had 3/4 of an acre. My house had 3/4 of an acre around it. Mm-hmm. And I planted some fruit trees. I planted some vegetable gardens, some flowers. I had lawn, a little of everything. And then actually, I got another acre and a half just to the south, a nice field. So. Instead of planting two of one kind of fruit tree, I decided to plant 10. Instead of planting two of another kind, I plant 10. So I figured this was really going to be more than a garden, but it was still less than a farm. So I figured I'd call it a farm den. And there have been some people. I have a blog, and when I mentioned it on the blog, some people concurred. They said now they have a name for what they feel like they're doing also. So it's either more than a garden, less than a farm, or more plants and land than one person can take care of sanely.
There you go. Well, Steve, you emphasize that gardening can build relationships within families and larger communities. How does that work?
Well, one of my main inputs for the spring thaw is my work with community gardens, and I like to call it community gardens, but more than a garden. And by that, working on the east side of Madison with the development of Troy Gardens, and my input with that was as a landscape architect that was able to be brought in 1997. and sit at the table with five different nonprofits, a coalition that had actually never been put together again, and to lay out and to comprehensively, kind of comprehensively, along with many community meetings and things, develop 31 acres for gardening, community shared agriculture, housing, education, and open space. And very, very exciting. And from that, our expertise in community development and bringing ownership to the people and empowering them is, I feel, very, very rewarding, something that our firm strongly believes in and is great for building community.
Absolutely. Well, by the way, I believe on our website, on my Facebook page, Judith has links to your firm and also Stephen, and also to Lee's work as well. So if you want to go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you can find the blog and all that, the other information. Well, what are the key elements before we go to the phones here? And we already have Jerry online. By the way, you'll be able to join in too, and Ken right now if you want at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. What are the elements of a landscape design, though? And well, let's start with you, Stephen, and then we can go to Lee.
Well, that's a pretty broad question. To me, the most important thing of in residential terms, in particular, is the connection of people to their landscape, comfortably being able to get into it and to have it be a usable open space, to have it be inviting, to have the gardens, if they're there, be exciting in view and easy to take care of is important. And really the connection with nature, and to make sure that people, even if they're not getting outside as they're entering their house or whatever, feel a positive response.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lee, you want to chime in?
Well, another aspect that I think I agree with all that, of course, but also I think people have to, often take sort of a personal assessment of, how much they're going to put into the landscape. And, say, especially since my specialty is growing fruit plants and I like to use them in the landscape.
Yes.
To sort of assess, you have to pick the plants that are going to jive with what you're going to put in. If you don't want to spend a lot of time, you don't want to pick a plant that you really have to pay attention for a lot of pest control or pruning. So really think of what you like to do, what you like to eat, how much you like to be outside, how much you want to learn about plants, and it's possible to do it at all different levels. You just have to make sure that what you plant and where you plant it, jives with your interests and your enthusiasm.
Yeah, and Steve, you were going to add something there.
No, that is the essence, is to coordinate your management practices with the plants and with what can be handled, and make it fun, inviting, and luscious.
It's got to be fun.
It really does.
It's got to be fun. There's no doubt about that. Well, Jerry in Waukesha has a question or comment for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Larry. I've got, I ordered raspberry bushes and strawberry bushes, and they came bare-rooted, and they came already, and we don't know what should we do with them. The strawberries have little green leaves on them already, and it's cold out.
Yeah.
When can I plant them?
Well, go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I would say, first of all, the cold isn't as much of an issue as soil. You don't want to work the soil if it's still too wet. But you can keep these for weeks even. All you want to do is keep them from drying out and keep them cool. So if you have an unheated garage, just unwrap them, make sure the roots are moist. If not, soak them in water a little, then repack them up in a plastic bag or around some other packing material that they came in. And you could put them in an unheated garage, even like along the north side of the house, just throw some mulch on top of them. I mean, you can't even really put them in your refrigerator. I don't know about the raspberries. That might be a little big.
That's a little big.
But yeah, no, just keep them cool and moist, and they'll keep fine for weeks
Well, what about, I mean, do I have to worry about frost when I put these raspberries in?
No. No, first of all, the raspberries, the growing point's below ground, and even the strawberries. Frost, if you're talking about frost, 32 degrees is not important, and it's probably not going to be getting down to 10 or 15 degrees still.
So you right? think? Do you think I could plant them now?
Well, I think you could plant them as long as the soil is not too goopy and wet and
no,
frozen.
No, he tilled the soil. It's pretty dry. It's in a well-drained area.
Huh?
And we were going to put them in and water them, but I thought, what if it frosts?
Well, I would say the raspberries would be okay because the growing points are all below ground. Maybe the strawberries, wait a couple of weeks or so.
Okay, I'll wait a couple of weeks for the strawberries.
Okay.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Would you like to turn your landscape into at least a partial edible landscape? How edible is your landscape? That's a good question I would pose to you. Other than vegetables, what do you plant that is edible in your landscape? So join in with your questions and comments. Now, do you incorporate, Lee, would you consider raspberries and strawberries part of the edible landscape in a person's home area?
Well, I have to say that when I talk about edible landscaping, I think the plants have to be truly edible and truly landscape-worthy.
Okay.
Now, strawberries and raspberries surely are truly edible, but I have to say I don't consider them to be the prettiest of plants. So I would definitely plant them because they're really worth growing, but I would not use them as part of something that's for beauty also.
Yeah. What would you use?
Oh, there's tons of, like, for instance, you mean of those type of plants or just any?
Yeah, I'm talking about any plants.
Oh, there's many, many very beautiful fruiting plants. For instance, a very common one, and my favorite fruit probably of all is blueberries.
Yeah.
I mean, these you know, they have really nice flowers in the spring. The foliage looks nice all summer long. In the fall, they have really nice fall color. In the winter, the stems turn a little reddish, and they have great-tasting fruit. I mean, blueberries is a plant for a less common plant, one called Cornelian cherry, mm-hmm. which is actually grown mostly as an ornamental, but every year it's loaded with tart cherries, very easy to grow.
Yeah. We need a pretty acidy soil for the blueberry, so it doesn't work uh-huh. everywhere in Wisconsin, but where it... actually, I guess you can amend the soil.
Right.
You have to kind of keep at it.
Soil. Yeah, they're growing blueberries now commercially in California soils that are quite alkaline.
Yeah. Steve, a comment from you on that.
Sure. Well, one of my favorites is you have to do a little bit more work to get at the fruit is the Amelanchier species. You know, Juneberries is another mm-hmm. name for them. They're stoloniferous varieties that are kind of suckering and very low have been hybridized in Manitoba and stuff for mm-hmm. for fruit, and they are of course a delight to the birds. They
yeah.
are the first berries ripe, and the cedar waxwings flock to mine every spring, which is wonderful. And sometimes I can't quite get to them first. But they do make great jams and jellies, and of course they have that most beautiful blossom, native to Wisconsin, and the fall color and things. So they are that is a plant that would fill both bills. You have to work a little harder to get the fruit, but
those are service berries.
Yeah, service berries, another name, Larry. You're
yeah.
right, exactly.
And some friends in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, they call them Saskatoon berries.
Absolutely. Yeah, and up there they are very widely appreciated and gathered.
And I've had... You know, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that's another one of those plants that mostly are grown as ornamentals, which just highlights how beautiful they are. They're grown mostly as ornamentals, and a lot of people who grow them don't realize that the fruits are even edible, and they're really quite delicious.
We have lots of callers online. Let's turn to Alan in Pembine, Wisconsin, next. Let's see here. Alan, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I appreciate very much the opportunity to talk to some professionals, but I have I had a big raspberry patch in the back, and it began to die out slowly. It didn't rejuvenate itself. Number one, why do you think that happened? And two, I knew that we weren't fertilizing the ground. Could that also be a reason why?
Hmm. And, let's go to Lee first and then Steve.
Okay. Raspberries are perennials, but as perennials, they don't really eventually they pick up virus diseases from wild plants and other diseases, and they sort of peter out. So that could be one reason why they were sort of fading out.
Yeah,
They also need regular pruning if they weren't pruned regularly. I mean, it could be also the fertilizer. You know, it's hard to tell just from that description. But I would say after about 10 years, a raspberry patch generally needs to be replanted in a new place.
Yeah. Steve, that's been your experience, too?
Yeah, that's very true. It's right on. It's very hard to tell exactly why, but a lot of times pruning and poor maintenance or just the length of the plant, and they are susceptible to viruses and things.
Yep, there we go. There you go, Alan. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Glendale, we are on to you. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I have a question as far as canna lily seeds that I get from the flowers at the end of the year. What's the best way to propagate them from seed? I don't have a problem with the bulbs. I have tons of those, but the seeds, I've had limited success in growing those from seeds.
I've never grown them from seeds. Lee, have you?
I haven't. I was gonna let Steve get that one.
Yeah, right. I have no answer for that. I'm sorry. My wife, the horticulturist, might, but unfortunately, she's not here.
I would say they are tropical bulbs. So I would say if you just sow the seeds immediately,
yep.
and just keep them warm, and wait long enough.
Okay.
All right.
Much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Dave in Boscobel next. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I got some grass in my yard, and it just keeps getting bigger spots. It's like turns brown. I was told once it was like zoya grass or bent grass.
Zoysia grass?
Yes.
That's not a good grass for growing here in Wisconsin. And they advertise it every spring. I bet you get those ads out your way as well, Lee.
No, I don't. It just, I never planted or anything. It just started to come in.
Oh, then it may not be.
It comes in spots, and the spots just keep getting bigger, and it's brown.
When is it brown?
It's brown right now, but I mean, after you, after you mow it or whatever, it just gets brown spots.
Boy.
I had a guy, we do a lawn service, have a lawn service come in, and one guy told me it was called bent grass.
Bent grass.
Yeah.
It could be a rust. There's a rust that is innate with bent grass. Can also be innate with blue grasses. What is it? Does it brown up just after mowing? Or
it's pretty much brown all the time. The spots are getting bigger and bigger. It's like it's expanding all the time. Last summer we just had a few little spots, and now they just kept getting bigger.
Yeah,
Could be a fungal problem also.
Yeah, you might
I've
have
got a hunch there.
You might have a fungal problem with it. That's one we're a little bit out of our area right now to make a good recommendation for you, Dave. I'm sorry we can't do that, but it could well be a fungal problem. It might be a shade issue that's shading out other grasses that are would perform better. We're just speculating right now.
Yeah.
And sorry we couldn't help you out more. Irene and Monona, let's go to you. Irene, hi.
Thank you very much. I couldn't help but laugh. I thought, I wonder if he has a dog.
Nah.
Every spring we get some brown spots from our dog. Question I had, I wasn't going to go on, but then the lady answering said that one of my questions had to do with some pruning, and that's... that would be okay. I have some boxwoods and they're growing around our, for the all of you black walnut people, we're having success with them. And I'm wondering, is there a variety that grows taller?
There are a lot of boxwoods actually come in all shapes and sizes. So, yeah. I mean, I have one that grows, it's almost like a pencil. It's about 6 inches wide. I mean, it'll get a little wider, but it's about 4 feet tall. But I think the main problem is that in Wisconsin, it's cold there, and you're pushing the northern limit for boxwoods, so every single variety that's available, all different sizes and shapes, aren't necessarily going to survive winter there without getting burned. So there are some, I don't know offhand the names of you know, all the different varieties, but if you you know, look around, you can find some. But the important thing is to really look at the hardiness zone for whichever one you get.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you were going to add something there?
Yeah, I am. I'm boxwood is one of my favorite plants, and there's a couple of varieties that that will get through a few winters without browning out. one of them is the Chicagoland series, Green Mountain, Green Velvet, and Green Gem, I believe. And the Green Mountain has a more pyramidal form. They I've found to be somewhat hardy. My favorite boxwood, of course, is the standard, the wintergreen, mm-hmm. which actually in the wintertime gets a little bronze. So, but I have one at, in my yard that, that I've had for 20 years. It's about 8 feet tall, but I've not pruned it. So they can get big over time if they're sited correctly. And I don't know outside of the Green Mountain of the other, there are some varieties that are very narrow, and, but I don't know what the cultivars are.
Yeah. I can remember the names of my new ones. I've got a Chicagoland that's grown for a long time.
Yeah.
And then I've got two that are small and rounder, and then another one that's growing almost in the shape of not a Christmas tree, but more conular.
That
rather than round.
Yeah.
That would be the Green Mountain, I think.
Probably the Green Mountain.
When would be a good time to prune those?
I would prune after flush in the early summer of June. Mm-hmm. June would be a good time. You want them to get a flush, nip that back, and then let them come on again. You don't want to prune boxwoods in the fall in particular, or any time through the winter where they will give them much more susceptible to a winter burn.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling today. Appreciate your call. We're talking about kind of luscious landscapes as part of the Green Bay Botanical Garden Spring Thaw Symposium. Our two guests today, Lee Reich and Steve Ziegler, will be presenting at the Spring Thaw Symposium. We'll talk more about that with you as well and take your questions at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
New York Times columnist David Brooks is fascinated by recent findings in psychology and neuroscience. He says many of our public policies fail because we're not actually the rational decision makers we think we are. I'm Jim Fleming. Sunday afternoon on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk with David Brooks. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Sunday at noon on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Friday, and time for your views on the news today after 4. Hi, this is AddIssue host Ben Merens, inviting you to a statewide discussion about the news of the week. Just what are your views? You know, it's all at issue later today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network as we talk with Lee Reich, author and avid farm editor, and Stephen Ziegler of Ziegler Design Associates in Middleton, Wisconsin, a professional landscape architecture and land planning and garden design firm. So great to have both of them with us today. Lee, by the way, what are you going to be discussing or talking about? Talk a bit more about what you'll be discussing at the Green Bay Botanical Garden Symposium.
Well, actually, the topic of my talk will be luscious landscaping with fruits.
What?
So using fruit trees, vines, and shrubs in the landscape to provide both food and beauty.
Okay, so you'll be zeroing in then on fruit trees and possibly grapes, things like that as well?
Yep, yeah, vines, trees, vines, and shrubs.
Okay. Well, we've got Mary in Madison who has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering how Serviceberry got its name, and also, where does it grow? Would it grow like in the Baraboo Devil's Lake where all the rocks and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Do you want to take that one, Stephen?
Well, I'll give it a shot. Serviceberry, I don't know where Serviceberry comes from. The other name for Juneberry is very indicative because here the berries are ripe in June and the first ones off the trees and the bushes. My experience would be that Serviceberry would grow just fine in the Baraboo Bluffs. It is applicable to many different soil types and is a native understory tree or edge species, as they would say in the Wisconsin area. So that would lend itself to the woodlands and woodland hills. There are varieties. The downy serviceberry is going to be a streambank species and can take a little bit more water. To get them started, you would need to make sure that they had adequate water until they got their root system established. So they prefer more fertile soil, but will do well on more abrasive soils like the Baraboo Bluffs would have.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know they don't like too much shade because I've got...
Yeah, they get a little thin.
I've got four serviceberries in a place that is a little too shady.
Yeah,
and
unfortunately. They're beautiful.
Yeah, especially if you want fruit.
Right.
Flowers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because in the woods often they grow in, you know, pretty shaded areas. Somewhat shaded, but there's a lot of plants like that. Blueberry also. Grows in somewhat shady, wild in somewhat shady areas, but really fruits best in full sun.
Yeah, and absolutely. That's the case. My service berries are, the plants are seem healthy and all that, but never any berries. It's just too much shade there.
That's true.
Let's go to an email here from Carol. It says, I love the show. I've read that if you put rock salt on the asparagus bed in spring, it will kill the weeds and grass without harming the asparagus. Is this true? And I know it's certainly not something we normally recommend, but what's your experience, Lee?
I've heard that has been recommended for, you know, many, many, many years. And I guess it really just reflects that asparagus can tolerate salt more than other plants. So you could do that. Not rock salt wouldn't necessarily be the salt to use. I would use any salt. On the other hand, salt is not very good for the soil. So my choice would be to get down on all, you know, hands and knees and weed.
Yeah, I
just because I have a real appreciation. I don't like to. Yeah, everything starts with good soil. So I would rather not compromise the soil. Just to make it easier to weed the asparagus. I mean, you know, if you weed asparagus bed thoroughly and then mulch every year and weed regularly just when you happen to see weeds, it really does not take that much time.
Chris in Shorewood, we go to you next. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I have a problem. I have a beautiful double lot that used to have grass and wildflowers around the edge, and then the flood came to Shorewood, Wisconsin this summer, and so my entire basement was in my yard for over a month with big tarps, and now I'm looking out, and it's a pretty barren, kind of almost mossy-looking grass, very bumpy and lumpy, and what do I do?
Sounds like you need to
call someone in. I don't want to use a lot of chemicals.
Right. And this sounds like a job for, although you're in Sherwood, somebody like... you, Steve.
Well, it would be, I think the thing here would be that it sounds like the lawn needs to be refurbished. I think you still want to keep grass from what I am interpreting. Mm-hmm. And if it has been really saturated and maybe even compacted from the flooding a little bit, it would be the thing to do. would be to add organic matter, mm-hmm. such as a composted leaf. There's a new method now of compost seeding, mm-hmm. which is combining a layer of an inch or two of leaf compost from, like Dane County has mm-hmm. that facility, mm-hmm. et cetera, with seed and tilling that into the soil and getting a nice even grade so that you're working good organic matter back in there to help the soil life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Lee would probably have something about soil, I would think.
Yeah, Lee?
I guess it's hard to say exactly what's going on there. So it does seem like some compaction. I mean, you have to reseed, it sounds like, and organic matter always helps. I have to say that lawns are not my expertise. I often get compliments on my lawn, but truly the only thing I do is mow my lawn.
And here, what does your landscape look like? Tell us about your landscape, Lee, at your home. You've got a little lawn, but you've got edible.
I got lawn. I have. I basically grow pretty much all the vegetables I eat. So I have about 2,000 square feet of vegetables, and then I grow a lot of fruit trees, and I grow more than I should because Well, that's because I write about it, so I feel like I have to test, you know, where a normal person might grow. I grow, you know, another nice landscape fruit is a hardy kiwi vine, which we didn't mention yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, the reason I mention that is because I always say, like, a normal household would grow two vines, but since I write about it, so I want to test them, so I planted 15 of them. So, well, you know, and so, you know, I plant 15 grape vines, I plant, you know, 25 apple trees. It's a little of everything, and a greenhouse,
and a greenhouse besides. Well, it sounds to me like Chris almost has a blank palette here, in some way.
Yeah, an opportunity.
Yeah,
look at it as an opportunity, Chris.
Well, I have raspberries and blackberries around the edge, fighting with the arborvita tree. I have a garden that is fighting with beautiful wildflowers. But it's sort of, sometimes in the summer is like a jungle. And when people, next door, the guy's a wonderful man, but they come with sprays and all manicured lawns. And I don't want that, but I do want my yard to look like animals can enjoy it again.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that is just you really have to organize things and really, you know, plan how much you can take care of well, and, you know, group things together, and it really is just a management problem. You just have to figure out not to just throw plants in the ground, but just, you know, think of, okay, make this a grouping, say, somewhere where it's a manageable area of plants, and you may put the raspberries there, and then have a certain amount of lawn. You know, one thing about luscious landscaping, I think, is that the landscape does not have to be 100% edible.
Yeah,
have non-edible plants too.
Yep, absolutely.
And of all the plants, you know, that are nice in a landscape that are really easy to take care of, I mean, lawn, you know, except for these special problems, lawn is very easy to take care of.
Yeah,
you just mow it.
Yeah, you just mow it.
Well, one thing to add on that would be use, maybe look at your lawn as a part of the quiet space in your yard that gives you access to the more wild areas so that it can be integrated in as an easier to maintain area that separates raspberries from the brambles or the underbrush or the trees from the garden and that you use it as a whole as a part of the design of the landscape and to also reduce your maintenance and management.
There are a couple of publications too through UW Extension on planning your landscape that if you don't want to get to a professional landscaper, it would be worth going to the Learning Store, UW Extension Learning Store, and there are, several publications that you can just look at free online if you want, or download them if you want, or even purchase them if you want as well. That would probably be worth taking a look at, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call, and good luck. We were talking earlier about fruit, and Lee mentioned, you know, Lee was talking about fruit a little bit, and we had an email from John who wondered what fruits can be started from free or low-cost sources, such as vine cuttings or seeds. Trees seem expensive for planting in any number. We'll go to Lee first for that.
Well, I sort of take issue with them being expensive. I mean, a good tree you might pay $20, $25 for, but you might enjoy it and harvest fruit from it and enjoy its beauty for, you know, 50 or 100 years. So to me, that seems like a bargain. But if you do want to do it more economically, one thing to do, which I happen to like to do, just because I'm sort of obsessed with doing this, is you make your own trees. You learn how to graft, which is not that difficult, and you either grow or buy rootstocks. And then there are all sorts of sources for organizations and government or both private organizations, groups of enthusiasts and government organizations where you can get what are called signs for grafting. And you get the rootstocks, you get the signs, and you make your own trees. And I do this all the time. I'd say, you know, 90% of what I grow, I did make myself. And then, you know, you learn how to take things, propagate plants from cuttings, and you have friends, and once again, these organizations, you can propagate, make new plants from that too. You could make a whole landscape. It'll delay, you know, set you back a year or two for, as opposed to just buying a plant from a nursery, but it is more economical, and it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it can be a lot of fun. And, Steve, do you want to add something there?
A little bit. One thing that I learned from my father was that we really coveted the American plum, which is native and grows all over. And many of them are not good producers, but every once in a while you find one, and he would basically gather the plums, and we would plant seeds and get those going that would be a little bit better producers. And another friend of mine, his father, who had a wonderful peach tree and would keep the seeds and propagate from that when the best peaches of the year. So you can do it from seed.
Well, actually, yeah, one thing to keep in mind with that is some fruit plants come more true from seed than others. For instance, peach actually often it's self-pollinating, so it's more what they call homozygous. So if you plant a peach seed from a good peach, there's a good chance you'll get a good peach. But if, for instance, apple gets cross-pollinated, so if you plant an apple seed from a good-tasting apple, the figure that breeders usually give is this 1 in 10,000 chance of you getting a good-tasting apple. So don't do it with apples, but do it with peaches and plums, I guess. And there are a few other fruits that you can do it also from seed. But it's really a fun thing. And, you know, probably the ideal thing is to do a little of both. Buy a few plants so you get the jump on time, and then start learning how and propagating a few plants yourself.
Good points. And we had Elizabeth in Washburn and Dan in Menominee Falls and Amy in Mineral Point all wanted to let us know how the service berry got its name. And that was a question we never did answer. It was the only thing blooming in the early spring when rural ministers would make the rounds to both marry and bury people, and the service berry was the only thing flowering to use for those services.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Oh, wonderful.
and we had it from three different people, so it has to be true. And I, you know what? I bet it is.
Makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Well, we're having some fun here on this edition of Garden Talk. Visiting about luscious landscapes with our two guests, Steven Ziegler and Lee Reich. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Lee Reich, author, avid farmer-gardener type here, and has written many books relating to the home garden and making. He's a guy that likes to talk about fruits and fruit trees, and he's written books like The Pruning Book, The Weedless Gardening, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, and Landscaping with Fruit. Steve Ziegler is a professional landscape architect, has his firm, Ziegler Design Associates, in Middleton, Wisconsin. Great to have them along. Again, you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email talk@WPR.org. The lines are all filled right now, but you can keep trying. And Jerry in Iowa County is up next. Jerry, hello.
Oh, hello.
What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just have a few things that came to mind while I was waiting. Your guests are absolutely right. Grafting, for instance, is really a lot of fun and really rewarding. Everybody should try that. The other thing about putting salt on the asparagus, don't do that.
No.
Don't do that. That doesn't do the dirt any good. My question is about autumn olive, and I think it is Russian autumn olive. Now, I do some, on the side, I do some timber stand improvement work, and I'm on a project right now where the forester wanted the autumn olive cut. Now, I planted autumn olive, and I'm wondering, should I take mine out? Is it invasive, or does it spread?
Yeah, Stephen?
Well, it's a very good question. Autumn olive has been used in forest reclamation, Wisconsin. It's actually the DNR has some of their not seeds but plants with that in it. It is aggressive and can be invasive. So you do need to watch it. If your forester is recommending removing it, it is probably beginning to start to control the ground layer. I don't know. I'm not there. But I would be very conscious of it. It would not be – it's something that I just don't recommend anymore planting because it can just get away. It does have attributes. It does actually have an edible fruit, mm-hmm. things like that. So there's all these wonderful components, but in Wisconsin, it can be invasive.
If I could just...
Yeah, go ahead.
If I could just interject something there. The caller said something about autumn olive or autumn Russian olive. That's two different plants. Autumn olive is much more invasive in the eastern part of the country. Than Russian olive. Russian olive actually is banned in a lot of Western states, but they are different plants. Russian olive, yep, is more of a tree. Autumn olive is more of a bush. And they're both, it's unfortunate that they are so invasive because they are both great plants. They improve the soil. They have very fragrant flowers in the spring. They're very pretty in leaf, and they do both have edible fruits. I brought some autumn olives to a gathering once. It was actually of small farmers. And I didn't tell them it was autumn olive because I thought maybe they'd start beating me up. So people really don't like it, the plant around here. I happen to love the plant. But I called it by the Japanese name because it's been called Akigumi in Japan. And everybody loved them. And I guess as long as they don't know the name. So anyway, it is. They can be invasive, but they are great plants. Yeah. And they are banned, actually, in some places. But mostly it's the autumn olive that's banned in the east, Russian olive in the west. And if it's small red berries pressed tightly to the stems, that's autumn olive.
There you go. Yep. Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. And Susie in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. I have an ever-bearing raspberry bush, and it's doing quite well, but the stalks are like 8 feet tall, which make them hard to cover for birds, and you can't pick that high. I'm wondering if I can cut those without worry about disease. And then my second question, go ahead.
I love that question because the answer is yes.
Okay, yeah. Great.
You cut them to about 5 feet would be a good height.
Okay, great. And then my second question, I have a grapevine that's about 3 years old, and it hasn't produced any grapes yet. It does a lot of grape leaves. The vines are really long. There's one central vine with two vines going off of it. Can I prune those back? Would that cause it to fruit, or what? How could I make this thing produce grapes?
All right. Lee, do you want to take that?
Yeah. Grapes, first of all, do need annual pruning for sure, and they should start bearing by about 3 years. But it's a little hard to do. It's much easier to show than to describe, but they bear fruit on canes, which are one-year-old shoots, shoots growing off canes, which are one-year-old shoots. So you can shorten some. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what you say you have, but anyway, if you look for pencil-thick wood that doesn't have peeling bark on it, that would be a one-year-old cane. So you leave about, you know, say 20 buds length total on the whole plant of that kind of wood, and you should get fruit growing off it. That won't necessarily train it to the right form, because really it's one thing that pruning does with grapes. It also lets a lot of light shine on the plant, and they really do need a lot of light. So I would, once again, turn to some publications that
there,
really
in
show
fact,
it clearly.
Yeah, in fact, there is a great UW Extension publication called Growing Grapes in Wisconsin. And I had a friend who had the same issues as you have, Susie, and he got a copy of the book or of the pamphlet, and he followed the directions exactly, and he's got more grapes than he could ever hope for. So Growing Grapes in Wisconsin, it's a UW Extension publication. You can get it at the Learning Store, .uwex.edu, and look at it online or just print it off.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And that gives you the visual that, you know, there's some nice diagrams and so forth in there, too, that help kind of help out.
If I might put in a personal plug also, there's a book called The Pruning Book
that
I wrote. That also has that.
That's exactly right. And we do have your page, your web page, but Lee, your name, your last name is pronounced, or I'm sorry, spelled
R-E-I-C-H.
R-E-I-C-H.
Yeah.
But you can, folks can go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and get all that information, but give it to us anyway here, R-E-I-C-H.
Of my web page?
Yes.
No. Oh, it's just Lee Reich, one word, LEEREICH.com.
There we go.
And that also links to my blog.
Okay, there we go. We have a question from Deborah who wants to know what kinds of edible plants will grow near a black walnut tree, and can you suggest edible landscaping for rain gardens or wet areas? So two different questions there. Black walnuts are kind of the scourge for a lot of, and I can't tell you how many people have called, and they don't have a black walnut tree, but the neighbor's got one right next to the lot line, and so they have lots of problems. Lee, have you have any? Well, I'm going to ask you both about this. First, we'll start with Lee.
I have to say that I keep, occasionally over the years when I get a question like this, I look up various lists on the internet of black walnut tolerating or you know, not tolerating plants, and I can't remember which ones do better and worse, but there are lists that you can look up that tell which plants will do better or worse under black walnuts.
Yeah, Extension's got a copy of that. Stephen, you?
I have two varieties that work. One is the hazelnut of Corallus americana, the American filbert, is symbiotic with black walnuts. I've had better luck with it and some with others. But the other one that is that I have found to be very prolific under black walnuts is the blackberries. The native blackberries out in Iowa County. There's some farms where I go out there that are walnut stands, and the understory is the blackberries, and they do very well. So that's a couple of them, although they get a little pricky, but they would work. But it is very hard to find good species with walnuts, so it's tricky.
What about edible landscaping for rain gardens or wet areas?
That
is a good question. Lee, any advice there?
Well, I guess for wet areas in Wisconsin, of course, is cranberries.
Yeah, that's true.
Mean, and actually, cranberries do not necessarily take... I grew cranberries once in a... It was a raised area behind a rock wall that was not really all that boggy. So you really can, if you really want to grow cranberries, you don't even need that wet an area, but they surely can take a wet area. You, of course, have to get the soil right for cranberries. They very similar to blueberries. They need a very acidic, very rich in organic matter soil that's relatively low in fertility. But for wet areas, it really depends if the drainage is poor. Well, I guess the drainage is poor if it's a wet area.
Yeah.
Most fruits do not like wet areas, but cranberry would be one. What I would do if I had a wet area and I really wanted to plant fruits is I would either find a way to drain the water away to make it drier, or to build mounds on which to plant. You know, if you make a wide mound a foot or more high of soil, you could plant a lot of stuff on that too.
Mm-hmm. There you go. We have Mary in De Pere next with a question. Mary, hi. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Actually, a lot now that you've heard more. We've got an old orchard, very old, and I guess my main question was on, we do a lot of the edible landscaping and natural landscaping, but bought the Saskatoon or Juneberry,
yep,
a variety of those, and they bloom well. They set berries, but then the berries are usually drying up. We don't harvest any fruit from those.
You're wondering about that. Yeah. Lee?
Well, that sounds similar to my Juneberries. Juneberries, even though they look very much like blueberries, they're actually related to apples and pears, and they share a lot of pest problems similar to those. So, for instance, in my yard, I have about maybe like a half a dozen Juneberry plants, and I've had them for 15 years or more. And I would say I might be exaggerating if I harvested more than a dozen fruits. Whereas, so Juneberries, but they're very spotty, and where they have pest problems, because 4 miles from my house, where the site's evidently more to their liking, the bushes are loaded with fruits. So I would say that, you know, there's all sorts of problems. You know, they get curculios, they get rust diseases, they get all sorts of problems in some places, very isolated patches. So I would say if you have those problems where you are with Juneberries, I would grow something else.
There we go. Lee Reich and Stephen Ziegler, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are having difficulties with the news, so we will bring you the news, I'm pretty sure of that, come the top of the next hour. And in the meantime, we'll just continue our discussion here on Garden Talk with our two guests, Lee Reich and Stephen Ziegler, as we talk with them about luscious landscapes. And again, I would invite you to call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Again, we'd love to hear from you. And we have Jeff in Madison up next with a comment or question. Jeff, hi.
Hi, gentlemen. God, I'm learning a lot here today. Thank you so much. I'll be developing basically a large produce gardens up in Richland County starting this year. And I plan on using a lot of compost, but now I'm reading things about this new persistent herbicide. I believe it's called Milestone or Millstone is the leading one. I think it's by Dow, but it apparently has such a persistent nature that I guess in North Carolina a lot of produce farms are having they got some of this, and it's just killing their crops years later. And I just wondered if you gentlemen knew of any of have heard of that being a problem, because I was planning on using like the county compost, and now I'm kind of afraid to use it.
You know, I don't know that particular herbicide. Lee, do you have any experience with it?
I can't remember. I recall if this is the same herbicide, but I remember there was one herbicide that was very persistent and would survive composting.
It's like a peraldide, or I'm sorry, and I don't have the article with me. I'm out and about, but I just didn't know if it's got me kind of. I'm not super experienced with this yet, and I'm just afraid of killing everything before I even start.
Yeah,
I would just be really careful where you get the compost from. There's a lot of places to get compost. I think that the herbicide, I'm not sure, was used mostly on hay crops, or so, you know, that would, you know, if the compost made from commercial hay, maybe that would be more of a problem than if it's made from, say, a municipal compost,
mm-hmm,
where it'd be lawn clippings and leaves and things like that.
Yeah,
I would just say be very careful and find out what raw materials went into the compost.
Yeah, Stephen, you were going to add something.
Well, yes, the Dane County leaf composting, if that's done right, it should get up to a heat ratio that will take pathogens out and also segue some of the herbicides. Although that is a problem, what Lee said, the municipal compost comes from leaf and twig matter, so the herbicides used on commercial or farm agricultural products should not be in there. So you just need to be very careful. I think that that as herbicides develop, they become longer term and they become a little bit more of a problem to get out of the environment. So that is truly an issue of watching where your herbicides come from.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Jeff.
Grow my own.
Yeah, that's the best.
Actually is the best. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Pete in Ellsworth next. Pete, hello.
Hey, guys. Hey, I got a question for you. I've got a 5-acre acreage, and I'm trying to be as self-sufficient as I can.
Okay.
I got fruits and vegetables and berries and bees and chickens and all. But I was thinking what I don't have is nut trees. And I'm wondering, in Wisconsin, are there certain nut trees that would make sense for me to grow? Would it be worth it? Like, will I get enough protein out of it to justify the space and the time? And also, I was wondering, do you prune nut trees like fruit trees, or do you just stick them in the ground? So basically, though, I want to know what species of nuts would make sense in Wisconsin.
Well, I've become a bigger and bigger fan of nut trees over the years. I planted chestnuts, which I highly recommend.
Okay.
And chestnuts, the important thing is plant varieties that will bear and grow well. For instance, obviously American chestnut, there was a lot of problems with. It's wiped out by chestnut blight. There are a lot of hybrids. But when I was looking for chestnuts, I was looking for ones that made large nuts, tasted good, were hardy, and were chestnut and blight resistant. And the three that I would most recommend now would be a variety called Peach, a variety called Eaton, and a variety called Colossal.
Okay.
Another nut that I highly recommend is filberts. But some of the European, I think that they should be hardy there, because where I am, I'm in New York, but I'm in the colder part of Zone 5.
Okay.
And there's some varieties that have been bred in Oregon of European filberts that are, the reason they were hard to grow in the East, European filberts, was because of Eastern filbert blight. And now they have either immune or resistant varieties, so I grow some of those also. And there's a lot of varieties. There's a lot of nuts. There's also there's some edible shagbark hickories, shellbark hickories. Black walnuts. Black walnuts are one of my favorite fruits, and those surely grow.
Is that a northern?
What's that?
Black hazelnuts. Can you do in the north?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want the large, really tasty nuts, grow the blight-resistant varieties. And some of those names are Lewis is one, Clark is another one, Yamhill is another one. But there's a whole bunch of new varieties that are really just came out that are disease-resistant.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple other things about nut trees in Wisconsin. There is, and in particular, the European varieties that are coming out of Oregon that are proving to be hardy in Wisconsin. There is some research being done in the Ashland area of by the co-op up there on their farm to grow the European hazelnuts, a filbert for oil production, which is very, very, a really up and coming profitable industry, agricultural production there. The other two, my favorite, of course, is the shagbark hickory. I think it's a nut that just can't be beaten. Another nut that that was actually developed in Wisconsin is the heart nut, which is a cross between a butternut and a walnut, and that was developed in the River Falls area. Not very well known, but a fun one.
But a fun one.
Yes.
There you go. Our guests today, Lee Reich and Stephen Ziegler, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls. Frank in Cedarburg up next with a question. Frank, hello. Thank you for calling.
As a NAFEX member, too, another NAFEX member, have a question about the Arona. Will the Arona plant sucker? from the roots.
I guess you're addressing that to me as a NAFEX.
Yes, I am.
Just for if people want to know, NAFEX stands for North American Fruit Explorers. It's an organization of fruit nuts, so to speak. and that's, I mentioned earlier, if you want to make your own fruit trees, you get scions and you get rootstocks. This is one source. You can get them from other members. And, yeah, I've been a member for a long time. It's a great organization. And if you want more interest in more information, go to NAFEX, NAFEX.org.
NAFEX.org.
So, so back to the question of aronia. I have to say once planted aronia, I consider it to be totally inedible. So I really blanked out all information I might have in my head about aronia.
All right, there we go.
Sorry.
They are a suckering plant, though.
They are a suckering plant. Yeah, okay, there we go. Janet in Oak Creek, we're on to you. Hi, Janet.
Hello. I have two questions.
Okay.
First one is I have two small sour cherry trees, and I am having to replace one of them. And that is a black Tartarian cherry, and the one that's remaining is an Evans Valley. So I'm wondering what would be a good match with that, with hopefully some good production.
Mm.
And second question is about pawpaws, if you have any information on those. I have two of those, and they're from the root stock, about maybe 4 years old. How soon until I can expect fruit? Do you have any good tips? And can you also grow those from seed?
Okay.
Well, pawpaw is one of those plants that a normal household would plant two, and I planted 25. So I have had some experience with pawpaws. Generally, they start to bear when they're about 4 or 5 feet tall, or five or six feet tall. So if it's gotten to that size, it should start to bear. What I usually suggest to people if they're starting to plant one is to plant the grafted tree because you get production sooner then from a grafted tree. And they are very easy to grow from seed. The one problem is that they start very slowly from seed. Often they don't show any shoots above ground till July, and then they grow very slowly. But over the years, then they start to pick up.
And then your first question was about sour cherries?
Yes, that's right. I have the Bally cherry that is okay, and the other one I have to replace, and that's the Black Tartarian cherry.
Actually, Black Tartarian is a sweet cherry.
Oh, that's a sweet one. Okay.
And the tart cherry, Bally, I can't remember if that's a sweet or a tart, but if it's a tart, tart cherries do not need cross-pollination, so you can plant any other. You don't need to take that into consideration.
Okay, well, thanks for the information. I must have been given wrong information then at the nursery center, so thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Deb and Parade of Sheen, on to you now. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I have just purchased some property that's up on top of a hill in the southwest Wisconsin Bluffs, and I have a garage wall that faces the east, and I would like to do pears. A couple of pear trees in espalier fashion against the wall. Is that something that you have any experience with?
Lee, have you got any experience with that?
Actually, I have, but I hate to be negative. pear trees are one of the pears and apples are the traditional espaliers of Europe that were developed in Europe. And espalier means two things. One is where you bend the branches in a certain shape, which is very decorative, and the tracery of the branches is actually part of the beauty of the plant. And then the other part of an espalier, if it's a fruit plant, is that the branches are loaded with fruit. Right. So with a pear tree, generally, you can do the first part. You can bend the branches, but in this part of the world, they will not be loaded with fruit, unless you do Asian pears, which should grow in Wisconsin. So if I was going to do that, I would recommend Asian pears, unless you just want the branches to be bent. You'll get some fruit. You just won't get a lot. With Asian pears, they're much more fruitful, so you tend to get a lot of fruit. And it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've found a little bit different take with espalier pears. I think they're actually a very wonderful plant to espalier aesthetically with the flower, the leaf, et cetera. The production of the ones that I've done that are producing pears that I do not know the varieties have produced just fine. Mm. And so it's I think it's a wonderful opportunity to give that a try. And a lot of times with the landscape of being able to decorate a wall with an espalier is just a delight in a small space to bring out that luscious landscape and to soften the architecture and to make an intimate space even more delightful.
Yeah, there we go.
Are there places where I can get plans for what the trellises should look like?
Lee, have you got an idea?
I was just going to say that there's a lot of, once again, books where you can just, the trellises, there's all different shapes you can train them to. So, and they're not that elaborate. And it's not necessarily trained on a trellis. You can use wires just to build up a basic structure. So I would look up some things on espalier, see what shape you happen to like for that wall, and then use wires or even, temporary canes, things like that, just to hold the branches straight while you're developing them.
Yeah. And Stephen, what's your experience?
Well, one of the fun things for me, of course, being a designer, is being able to design the trellis for the wall, the garden, and the gardener, so to make it a part of their trellis, and that might not lead to the best fruit production, but
it looks good.
It looks wonderful.
There we go.
I think actually that's a good point because I guess my tendency is more to look to production and landscaping, and maybe another way to look at it, obviously, is to look more at landscaping and some production, perhaps. So, I think now that I'm rethinking it, it's a good idea because you will get some pears, and go for the design, and you'll get a few pears, too.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Deb, for calling. We got Roxanne in Polecat Crossing.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Roxanne.
I'm one of your faithful mail carrier listeners.
Ah, there we go.
So that's where I am. My question is about nanny berries. One of my customers has a row of nanny berries. They're very prolific berry-wise. The birds love them. And I've never seen them in a catalog, and I'm wondering how different they are from service berries.
Yeah, well, Stephen?
Well, nanny berries, at least in common names, can be different, are a viburnum species, viburnum lentigo. And they are native to Wisconsin, and they are very prolific, and they have the berries that the birds do love very much. A service berry is actually the Amelanchier species, Amelanchier canadensis or Liavis, whichever variety it might be. So they're two completely different plants. If the nanny berry you're talking about is what I believe the normal common name is. Is that correct?
All he called them was nanny berries. He was gifted them, and they grow like weeds, and they're tall, fast-growing, lots of shoots. And
that sounds like a nanny berry.
So anyway, how can I find some? Are they in catalogs? Do I just go dig some from him?
You can certainly dig some, and that would be it's a very good time of the year. You can dig up some shoots and plant them or pot them, and I would think they'd take off. They're very prolific in that sense, but they are also a horticultural species, so they should be available through nurseries, catalogs, garden centers, et cetera. I use them in my plans in my wildlife and native habitat plantings quite a bit, and they're a good, solid producer. A few diseases, a little bit, but real
pretty
good.
So
they should be available. I'm surprised.
Okay, I'll start looking.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Steve in Madison. It's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Ziegler. I have a friend who has been trying, with no success, to find reproduction millstones so that she can build a little memorial to past pets in her yard. She's in the Madison area, and I wondered if you had any idea where she might turn.
Stephen?
Boy, there are some places I just do not have that information right now, but there are a specialty place some in Vermont and one in Michigan. I can get you in touch with those sources, but you'd need to contact me through my office to do that.
So you can go. He can go online to your website, probably.
That's
and
right.
Contact there. And what's your website?
It's a ZDA, INC. .com.
All right, so, ZDAINC.com.
Right.
Okay.
And yeah, we'll be able to take care of you there. I could get you in touch.
And I think that's up on our Facebook page, too. So if you want to take a look at the Larry Mueller Show, you can, all of these sites that we're talking about, we've put them, Judith's put them up on the Facebook page. So it's handy to have that there. Thanks again for calling. Danny in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Danny.
Hi, guys. We just moved into our house in Green Bay in October, and we have a cherry and a pear tree in our backyard, and I know nothing about them, what kind of, you know, types of cherries or pears, what the harvest is like. I do know that they're pretty well established, but I guess I don't know anything that I should be doing to them to upkeep them, or if I just leave them alone. And
mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I would say the main thing is pruning. They do need, both trees need annual pruning, so you should do that, and that would be, you know, 90% of what's needed. Mm-hmm. As far as the varieties, it would be hard to tell. There's about 5,000 varieties of pear.
Okay. Prune them what time of year and how much?
Now. And I guess the short answer to the pruning for pears would be anything that's growing very vertically upright, just cut it off.
Okay.
Anything that's drooping way down, cut that off. So you have a lot of horizontal and, you know, sort of upward pointing branches.
Mm-hmm.
And for the cherry, it sort of depends on what type of cherry. I would just sort of thin it out. If you, wherever it looks too crowded, cut out some wood. And if some wood looks old and decrepit, shorten it. And that would be a good start.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Do I have time for one more quick one?
Sure.
I've got a major box elder tree in my backyard. It's got about a 6-inch major branch coming off that I would really like to cut down because I've got my compost pile underneath and want to open it up. Is it too late to do that? Should I wait till next fall or next winter?
Now is a fine time to prune just about everything.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
You can take it down.
And about a 6-inch branch, so should I probably throw some paint on there afterwards?
No.
Nope, just leave her open?
Leave her open.
Okay. Thank you very much, guys. Have a good weekend.
Yep, thanks a lot. Well, we used to recommend painting all the time, and the problem some experts have told me is that you can get disease growing underneath that.
Yeah.
Right, it seals in the moisture, and the plant naturally heals itself when left untouched.
We had Gary, who's listening via the internet from Charlottesville, Virginia, wondering how far south can you plant sour cherries.
I don't know.
You can definitely plant them in Virginia.
Yeah, should be able to plant them in Charlottesville.
Yes, yeah.
So you're okay, Gary. You're all right. Mike and Prairie du Sac, we'll go to you next.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that I've been using fruit bushes and trees for landscaping, and I have a plum tree and a plum bush for cross-pollination. I have two elderberries. I have sweet cherry bushes, which are out now. Some of the seed catalogs list them as sugar sweet cherry bushes. I have blackberries, a Concord grape, gooseberries, currants, a peach tree, and I have fiddlehead ferns growing. Haven't tried them yet, but they say you can eat the tops of the fiddlehead fern. It's kind of like asparagus, and I have asparagus growing. And I grow herbs in pots along with flowers and grasses and use pots. And I've made flower beds along the house, the sides of the house. And I have a garden out back, which I've got all this into my landscape.
Sounds like a farm den.
Yeah, you've got a luscious landscape for sure. Judith wants to come over right away.
Well, I'm trying to be self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And always have something growing. Plus, if I find the space, I'm
looking to grow some more things in the future, but my yard is only so big, and I got it getting it pretty full now. But I just wanted to share that with you.
Oh, thanks a lot for calling. So it can be done, that's for sure. And I appreciate that call. It's a good positive statement here as we talk about all the different things you can do with to make your landscape a luscious landscape. But Bonnie emailed to say, we were talking about trellises just a minute ago. Bonnie emailed to say that you can make a trellis at Shake Rag Alley in Mineral Point. They offer many classes to choose from. And if you want to make your own, I would check. I bet if you go online to Shake Rag Alley, I'm almost positive that's going to pop up. And you're going to be able to learn about the trellises and so forth. Well, are you guys looking forward to the symposium, the Spring Thaw Symposium?
Yeah, next week.
Yeah, it's next week. It's Saturday, and I think people could still register for that, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, Steve's shaking his head yes.
Yeah, registration's still open for that, from what I understand.
So I wanted to get some information in about that, because both Stephen and Lee will be featured at the symposium, as will Mark Dwyer. And Mark, director of horticulture at Janesville Rotary Garden, another great speaker who's been a guest on this program, will be on tap as well. Starts at 8 o'clock in the morning with registration. 9 o'clock welcome, and then we've got 9:15, we got Lush's Landscaping with Lee Reich. A little break at about 10:30, and then Steve Ziegler comes on, talk about edibility, food production, and community building, and then lunch, and then an ornamental edible containers with Mark Dwyer, and we'll be talking about that. And then there's a plant preview from Jane Wass of the Mayflower Greenhouse as well. So there's a lot to – that's going to be a packed day with a lot of – tell you, you're going to learn a whole lot in a pretty short period of time. And if you want to get some more information on this, you can go to Sharon Vaughn. Sharon has a phone number. It's 920-491-3691. Judith, do we have that up on the Facebook page? Yeah, we've got that up on the Facebook page. So if you want to find out – some more about getting registered and taking this in. Again, it's Saturday, April 9th from 9 to 3. Member price, $45. Regular price for non-members of the Green Bay Botanical Garden Society is $60. There's lunch included in there, so it's a pretty good deal all the way around. And, guys, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. The time flew by.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
And when are you flying in, Lee?
Next Friday.
Ah, so you're coming in Friday. So you'll get a chance to see the Green Bay Botanical Garden. It's quite a facility.
Yeah.
It's really something to see. And Steve, have you been there?
No, I haven't. And I'm very excited about it, too. I've heard a lot of good things and very impressed with meeting and getting to know Sharon Vaughn a little bit.
Yeah.
And it seems like a very energized facility.
Oh, it's really worth taking in. And I'm glad you guys could be with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Lee Reich. Dr. Lee Reich, an author, avid farmer and gardener, and author. And we've got his website up for you and his way to get to his blog. You just go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You'll get that. Steven Ziegler of Ziegler Design Associates in Middleton, Wisconsin, professional landscape architect, land planning and garden design firm, and both of them will be at the Spring Thaw Symposium from Green Bay Botanical Garden. Just to let you know, coming up Monday, Peter Green of InfoStar will be here to talk about personal computers, and then Tuesday, Judith's going to host as we talk with the International Crane Foundation folks about the Midwest Crane Count. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.